Welcome back to Reboot with Dr. Arasi Maran. I'm your host, Dr. Arasi Maran. Today, we are diving into critical topics related to women's health. Joining me today is Dr. Priya Kalyani. Dr. Priya Kalyani, I know her from my medical school days. She heads the infertility center called Kana in Chennai and Tamil Nadu, India. I want to discuss so many different things with her, but a lot of things which are not frequently discussed. Dr. Priya Kalyani also runs her own show called Familiarize. With the tagline, let's get the conversation started. And I'm hoping we get a lot of conversation started as well.
Thank you.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Kalyani.
Yeah,
how are you doing?
Thank you so much for the invite, Arasi.
All right. Let's start with, women's health or little girls' health. You know, a little striking and a little concerning trend globally, and India is no exception in that matter, is early puberty. We are seeing our girls get, their menstrual cycles at the age of 9, at the age of 10, which is pretty alarming.
Yes.
What do you think is going on about this?
So, as you have rightly pointed out, there is a trend towards early puberty, and this could be linked somehow to the increased weight we see in our girls nowadays, because as you know, there's a certain weight which is needed before it kickstarts the hypothalamus to start functioning and release GnRH and all the other processes
hormones
to fall into place for puberty or menarche to actually start. And now they are hitting that age much sooner than we did when we were young, or our parents did when they were young. Our mothers did. So right now I would say it is more of the increase in childhood obesity, mm-hmm. which is a major factor. Second, there is a lot more environmentally, we are living in a slightly more polluted conditions than we were before, with exposure to multiple toxins and environmental pollution. So all these factors do play a role in kickstarting puberty early. Average, I would say, I nowadays see teenagers who are 13 or 14 weighing about 60 or 70 kg, which didn't weigh when we got married.
Yeah.
So times have changed, and with that, the exposure to all the fast food culture, all the online food delivery apps. So I would say there's no simple answer. It's definitely multifactorial.
But, you know, we all talk about this increasing rates of childhood obesity. How much is being done to help the awareness of it, or educating the parents about the, you know, dangers of the fast food industry?
Definitely. I would say it should start right from the beginning. As Indians, we are very, very programmed to think that somehow eating well is paramount for good health in the future.
Yes.
And when you eat well in your childhood, it somehow makes you magically more stronger when you reach adulthood. So that is no longer the case nowadays. So when the parents come to me, I would say, okay, does the child earn? No. Do they go and get it for themselves? Whatever fast food or the biscuits or the chocolates, which they, I say, they complain that they're consuming on an everyday basis. So as parents, it is us who are buying it for them.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, she doesn't eat anything if I don't give her anything else. She throws tantrums. She starts crying. Yes, that's part and parcel of childhood and growing up. But certain things, we have to be strong, draw the line, keep certain household rules. And mostly, I would say, set an example as parents by following a healthy lifestyle yourself.
Yeah.
So kids are not going to listen to advice anymore. They are going to see you observe and learn.
Mm-hmm.
So how you lead your life, what you eat, are you exercising regularly? Are you on the screen all the time? All this is going to impact your children and how they grow up in their own lives.
Absolutely. I hear this term, endocrine disruptors. You know, it comes in the form of lotions, it comes in the form of sunscreen, like so many. Is that really a thing? I mean, do you think that's adding, or what are your thoughts?
Definitely. EDCs or endocrine disrupting chemicals are a big topic of interest right now, and they have been postulated to be responsible for a number of things, right from the obesogenic factor which they play. They definitely increase the rates of obesity by changing our hormone levels, from reproduction, rising rates of infertility, thyroid dysfunction, certain cancers. They have been responsible for a lot of things as such, and they are all around us.
Yes.
Even if we were going to go and live in the Arctic, we are not going to be able to escape totally the exposure to EDCs.
The other funny thing is, asking age of menarche is become a part of my cardiac history, because women who have had early menarche, or early menarche is basically a term for age at the onset of menstrual cycle, age and menarche implicates whether what the cardiac risk is going to be itself. So imagine me as a cardiologist now asking, hey, do you remember what age you got periods? How is this affecting? I mean, are you seeing patients or female patients with emotional distress conditions, because they are so young, they are children, they are little children now who have to deal with the menstrual issues.
Menstrual issues, and I think the parents or the mother, especially in this case, should educate them about what is coming and what to expect, that periods are a biological phenomenon period.
Yes.
So don't think of it as something which is unclean, unhygienic, any toxin being excreted from your body. It's right. It's very important to give the right message to the girls.
Yes.
It's a biological phenomenon which is happening month on month, and it is necessary to take care of your health during that time. It is nothing to be alarmed about or ashamed about. So that's where, especially in a society like ours, especially in the rural areas, we still have so many taboos associated with menstruation. Thankfully, the situation is changing. So, and now kids are exposed to a lot more information online. So even though the mothers are not talking about it, they talk about it with their friends, they go online and look it up themselves. I was pretty shocked. Just the other day, I had my friend bringing her daughter to me, and she said, Akka, please talk to her about menstruation, what she should be knowing.
Yes.
So I was just explaining the very basics, and I said there are different sanitary products you can use, probably sanitary napkins. And she said, Akka, she knows all about that. She was asking me whether she can use menstrual cups, and she's 9 years old.
Oh my God.
I knew about menstrual cups when I was 40 years old. I was pretty shocked. I said, no, that may not be the right choice for you. So you can imagine that the exposure so much nowadays. So, but it is right. It is very important that they have the right kind of knowledge from the right sources rather than believing everything they see online.
You know, I think you segued into an interesting but maybe a not so spoken topic here. You know, in the US, the girls know tampons. Okay, tampons are not a big deal. How is tampons thought of in the Indian scenario?
So in the Indian scenario, people are going to be very worried about putting anything inside the vagina, because they have been taught that it is not accepted practice feel what is there. As a result of that and total lack of sex education in the schools, people do not know what the vulva is, the vagina is, what goes where. What they have themselves, they don't understand their own bodies.
That's truly sad.
At least that is changing right now, again with awareness on social media. But again, as I said, with the important disclaimer that you should be sure you're getting it from the right sources as such. And tampons, acceptance is slowly increasing. They don't really think about the concept of virginity, the presence of the hymen not being there being a cause of leading to speculation about your sexual history in the future.
Yes.
All these concerns are there. But menstrual cups are being used even by teenagers right now. Not very often, but still it has started, I would say.
For kicks and giggles, let's say, what would the advice you would give to this 9, 10, 11, 12 population about how to take care of a menstrual cup?
Menstrual cup, I would not suggest for someone as young as 9, 10 or 11. Probably once they hit about 14, 15, when you have the small size cup is when I would talk to them about menstrual cup, because if you do not use it in the proper manner without hygienic measures, it could definitely result in infections and a lot of pain and discomfort. And those are not things that you want to really make sure that the younger ones are really responsible enough to follow.
And I mean, if I remember my obstetrics right, menstrual cycles are not that very regular in younger women, right? And that could also lead to kind of confusion about what to use and what not to use.
Yeah, best would be to stick with sanitary napkins, tampons, if they were so inclined, that would also work. But now you have your period underwear, so which is also much easier for them to use rather than the cups, which takes a little bit of practice to get it right. And initially, it would definitely be uncomfortable in a person who has not been sexually active.
Sure. I think if I have to move to the next phase of a woman's life, it would be, you know, getting pregnant and thing. And like how in one end, we have onset of age of menarche coming down. On the other end, we have infertility rates rising up. It's really climbing. I mean, literally in countries like Japan, they are literally giving women paid holidays so that they have more children. What is going on there?
So infertility, you would think in a population like India, doesn't really matter because we are the most populous nation in the world. But again, infertility can be heartbreaking. I often tell my assistant doctors, the things women do and go through to have that one single child is absolutely heartbreaking sometimes. And in a country like ours, you have a lot of societal expectation placed on them. You become a sort of misfit in the society, and you're just sometimes social ostracization when you're not having a child. So all these do come into play. Rising rates of infertility is definitely there, as you can see by all the fertility centers mushrooming all over the country, across the cities and across rural areas. And IVF is definitely on the rise, even in a country like ours, where it is not covered by insurance.
Yes.
But the reasons for this are again very, very multifactorial. One is rising age of marriage. People want to get educated, settle in their careers, and then have children later on in life. But sadly, our bodies have not caught up to our minds.
Absolutely.
So we are born with what we have, and women are slightly more disadvantaged there because we are born with all the number of eggs we'll ever have for life, and then it's going to keep on getting lesser and lesser across age groups. So after your 30s, there's going to be a drop. After 35, a steeper drop, and by the time you hit 40, the chances of spontaneous conception are going to be very less month on month. So age is a major factor. Other than that, what we already talked about, like the EDCs, exposure to environmental toxins, everything can have an impact, and we see lower ovarian reserve. Mm-hmm. Obesity rates are rising, so we see increasing rates of PCOS and ovulatory dysfunction. Sexual dysfunction is a silent epidemic, which is definitely not addressed, and it is highly rampant right now, both in men as well as in women.
Okay.
So all these do contribute to increasing rates of infertility.
Do they immediately jump to IVF? What is the process when, how do you even say a person, a couple is not, you know, unsuccessful in producing a child?
So typically we take a history. It starts right from there, and we want both the partners to be there because sometimes it's only the woman who comes in a country like ours because the man is never at fault.
Of course.
But you know that it is roughly half and half. Both are going to be equally responsible for the creation of a child. And even for the miscarriage rates, the male partner has an important role to play. That is what we say. Just because we carry the babies doesn't mean that the fault always lies with us, because for the creation of the embryo, you have 50% egg, 50% sperm. So only both of them are ideally healthy, they're going to be having a healthier embryo.
Okay.
So I always make that point across, because here, often in India, otherwise you find a lot of blame being unnecessarily placed on the women as such.
Yes.
So when they come, we take a history, we ask them how long they have been trying. And what does trying mean? People think that they have sex about once or twice in a month, that is sufficient to get them pregnant. And it doesn't work their way. So right then, we start educating them about how is their ovulation, when is ovulation day happening, are they having sex around the time of ovulation.
Okay.
All this should be got into, because the problem ends right there. And we see a lot of couples who have not initiated intercourse after marriage for months, years, up to even 5 to 7 years, they have had proper penetrative intercourse, which is essential for getting you pregnant in the first place. And then once we have the history, we take certain basic tests for the man as well as the woman. Depending on the test results, then we start talking about treatments if they are required. And it is never IVF as the first choice unless there's major problems like azoospermia, total lack of sperms, or bilateral tubal block in the woman. So we would start with the simpler treatments, as in the ovulation induction and follicular study. Does not work. Pass on to an IUI or intrauterine insemination. Does not work. Then maybe talk about IVF, and this is very, very individualized depending on that particular couple's case scenario.
Priya, one of the things is still a taboo, you know, in most societies, and I think that information is not known about this, exercising during menstruation. What advice would you give it to the girls?
I would say do what feels right. There are a lot of myths associated with menstruation, not only exercise. Can you eat certain things or food groups? Can you water plants, believe it or not, or they will be built? And can you have your hair washed or something bad will happen? There are so many myths associated with menstruation and exercise is just one of them. So exercise is definitely not contraindicated or something during menstruation. But having said that, there are few girls who are going to be facing a lot of menstrual cramping, pain, heavy flow and things like that. So do what feels right for you. If you do not feel like exercising, do something light impact, low impact exercises are fine. And if you feel fine and your cycles are perfectly okay, you have the energy for it, go for it. It doesn't really matter.
And then how about sex during menstruation? That is also like a kind of a confusing topic or something like that.
Sex during menstruation is definitely not contraindicated. Again, it is personal preference. Actually, blood acts as a natural lubricant, so actually some people may prefer to have sex during menstruation. It can be messy, you have to use towels or something on the bed as such, and but other than that, it is totally not going to increase your chances of infection or something like that.
So I mean, it's just not like an unsafe practice, or it's not going to increase the chance of some pelvic infection or infection for the men or anything of that sort.
No, because there's no infective pathogen in the menstrual blood which is coming out. So unless you had some pre-existing infection or something, it's really not going to increase your chances of infections.
So you are saying every menstrual cycle, each ovary produces simultaneously one, there are two ovaries, right side and a left side. So let's stop there. So each ovary produces one egg, or 1 month the right side produces and the next month the left side produces?
It is absolutely sporadic, and sometimes one ovary may be more dominant and take over and always keep ovulating each month. So for basic reproduction knowledge, you have the uterus, you have two tubes on either side, you have two ovaries on either side. So each egg, each month, one ovary should put out one egg. It can be your right or the left, and that is absolutely up to chance. It should go without any block in your tubes through that side tube. And when you have sex, the sperm are released in the vagina. They will swim up through the uterine cavity, go and meet this egg which is waiting in the tube. If they both join, they form an embryo, and then that embryo starts dividing, and by day 5, it comes and gets implanted into the nice cozy lining which the uterus has formed for it. So that's how pregnancy should occur ideally. When you do not ovulate, you have irregular cycles, you have PCOS, other conditions, then you may need ovulation induction as a basic step. So we give you medicines, form an egg, and we track it by a scan called as a follicular study, starting day 10 or 11 of your cycle, to check whether the medicine which we have given has worked and done its job, and if it has made you form a dominant follicle. So this keeps getting bigger, and once it reaches a certain size, if the egg is not getting released spontaneously, we give an injection to make it release the egg for ovulation to occur and ask you to have sex at that time. So basically, we are just making certain that everything which should happen naturally is happening on track. Are you forming a follicle? Is it getting released? Are you having sex at the time of ovulation? Which is when you would have about a 15 to 20% chance of getting pregnant in that month.
So it's like an augment or an assisted reproduction. You're just, whatever is happening naturally, you're doing it. You're just giving it a little boost in the beginning of the
thing. A little nudge to make sure things are happening on time.
Okay, okay. So that is ovulation induction. So what is IUI?
Intrauterine insemination is a step, one step further from this, where we do the same ovulation induction, same follicular study to monitor the follicular growth, same injection for the egg to get released. But instead of asking the couple to have spontaneous sex around the time of ovulation, we ask the male partner to come, provide a semen sample. We process that semen sample. To make them understand, I say we just filter it out, sort of take out the debris, filter out the highly moving sperms, select them and put them inside the uterine cavity, basically placing highly moving sperm a little closer to meet the egg. So helping it, reducing the distance it has to travel to meet the egg, basically.
Is it done for more male infertility conditions than the female infertility conditions, IUI?
No, not specifically for male infertility because it doesn't increase the sperm counts.
Okay.
We are just taking the highly moving sperms and putting it a little closer. And if the counts were really poor, really bad, this is really not going to help. Though I would say anything about post-wash, the highly movement, the highly motile fraction of the sperm count, if it is somewhere around at least more than 5 million, or the basic minimum, I would say, is more than 1 million, then it's worth giving a shot with IUI, which is much less expensive as compared to your IVF.
And less invasive on the women's body also.
Definitely.
You know, we talked about women's health. Let's briefly dive into men's health. I mean, what can a man do to make his swimmers healthy?
Yes, globally we see sperm counts are on the decline.
Yes, and I also saw the sperm sizes decreasing as well.
It is just, we don't know why this is happening, but this is not only in India, it's across the world. So again, so many factors associated with their own health, their own lifestyle, the environmental conditions, everything may play an impact. When I did my undergraduation, the normal semen counts were, the reference ranges were 60 to 120 million.
Okay.
Then that was in undergraduation. Then in post-graduation, it was somewhere the second edition came where it was like revision came where it was more than 20 million is okay. Right now, we say more than 15 million is okay. Mm. So even across this decade, I would say there has been a decline in the sperm counts.
Goodness.
And this is something which you will not know unless you test for it.
Yes.
There is no symptom of a low sperm count. He's going to be perfectly normal, normally functioning male. His sexual libido is going to be fine. His sexual functioning is going to be fine. He does not have to have premature ejaculation, erectile dysfunction, nothing. But still, his counts may be very low or it may be even nil, which is called as azoospermia. So unless you do a semen test, there is no other way you can determine if he's capable of fathering a child.
Oh, wow. That's kind of a little scary. It's almost like, what is nature trying to, is nature giving us a message? It is increasing the rates of infertility. It is decreasing the sperm counts. In the cardiology side, I am seeing the age at which heart attacks are happening much earlier.
Yeah.
Is the earth trying to tell us a message that
yes,
we are
I'm
doing
too much
to it?
Yes, I'm very scared for the next generation is what I would
it
say.
It kind of sounds scary. I think our previous generation and us too have not taken care of this earth enough.
Especially when we look at so many young girls, even if they have been married in their early 20s, we are pretty surprised we see very low egg counts in them, which is totally not expected at all. You know that fertility is going to decrease with age, but this is not something you expect in your early to mid 20s.
Sure.
And poor ovarian reserve is a major problem, which is definitely not rectifiable by easy means, by any easy method or treatments. And sometimes donor eggs becomes the only option, which is highly distressing for the couple. And also with these low sperm counts, I would say, when I was talking to my daughter and she keeps saying, I will get married when I'm 28 and now she's made it 30. And I say, you can get married when you find the right partner. There's no age criteria for it. Only when you find the right guy, you're going to get married. So, but if you do not get married beyond a certain age, I'm just going to freeze your eggs. So if that was said as a reproductive physician mother, but I will say, looking at the current scenario, it is a little scary for the future.
I mean, I know you are a reproductive physician, mother, you're saying that. But as a feminist person, I'm like, don't force yourself into a relationship
The
clock is ticking.
No.
That's why I said
freeze eggs rather than just get married in a hurry just to reproduce.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I hope there is some some relief to this infertility problem, not just in the form of, the women are kind of ovarian reserve going down. How would you even measure the ovarian reserve in a woman? How would I know, not now, but in my 20s or 30s, what my ovarian reserve was?
So there are two kinds of tests. One is your ultrasound pelvis, which is very, very cheap and easy to do in a country like India compared to the US. So that is the basic minimum. You check your uterus, you look at your ovarian size, the volume, and we measure something called the antral follicle count.
I finished OBGYN long time ago, Priya.
So AFC or antral follicle count, this is in the week after you get your periods. We do a basal transvaginal scan if the girl is sexually active. and we look at the number of small follicles which we can count, which are somewhere between 2 to 5 millimeter in size. This gives us a rough indicator of whether it is fine or if it is looking very low for her age. So that is on the ultrasound. So this shows probably the quantity of eggs she may have, a marker of her ovarian reserve.
Okay.
The first marker is age. Second is the antral follicular count.
Okay.
And third is your blood test called as the AMH. You have ovarian reserve tests like the LH hormone, FSH hormone and AMH hormone or anti-Mullerian hormone.
That's one thing I still remember. I'm very proud of myself.
Yes. So you'd look at these. If they are within normal range, it is okay. If they are very less, again, I will tell them and I will reassure them that having a low AMH in no way means you can't get pregnant.
Okay.
It does not mean that the quality of eggs is very less. Even last week, we had two women with very low AMH counts, about 0.5 and 1, where typically it is said to be very low. They got pregnant with an IUI cycle. It takes only one egg, one sperm in a cycle to get pregnant. It means you have a lesser number of eggs present in your ovarian reserve or vault, which is typically available for you to use throughout your lifetime. But it doesn't mean the quality of those eggs are really poor and you're still capable of having a child. Just don't postpone childbearing into your 30s or late 30s because again, it's not going to get better with time.
Yeah, I still remember when I had my second baby, I was just about the age of 35 and they put in my chart, elderly gravid. I was like, what? What are you saying?
Yeah, because 35 and above, we typically want to call them like elderly. Yeah. Though I know now that's the norm right now.
I was like, how dare you call me elderly gravid?
I'm not ready to hear that term.
Yes, absolutely. So IUI. So IVF is completely... Talk about that. It's completely outside.
So IVF, to simplify it, is there are multiple steps. So this ovulation induction or stimulation is the first step. So here we are going to give you a lot more medications and injections at a higher dosage because we want to form how many ever follicles and eggs we are able to get.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to give you injections for 10 to 12 days. Keep doing the follicular scan to check how the follicles are growing.
Okay.
Once they reach a certain size, we are going to trigger them by giving a HCG injection or another hormone which is called as a GnRH agonist injection to make them release those eggs. From that, we calculate the timing. 35 to 36 hours later, we do a ovum retrieval. So this is done under anesthesia as a day care procedure. Mm-hmm. We do a transvaginal scan, inject a long needle, collect all the eggs which are present inside those fluid-filled follicles.
Mm.
So we aspirate all those follicles. The embryologist looks at that fluid under the microscope sitting there to check if there are eggs present in those follicles, takes all the eggs out. Next, there are two methods of fertilizing the eggs. One is we ask the husband to give the semen sample, take the sperm, process it, put it along with the eggs, put it in a dish, and check for fertilization the next day about 16 to 18 hours later to check whether they have fertilized. The other method is called as ICSI, where you take one egg, you take one sperm under a machine which is called a micromanipulator, you inject the sperm into the egg and then you keep it aside to check if fertilization has occurred the next day typically. So there are two methods of fertilization. One is standard IVF or conventional IVF and the other is ICSI or intracytoplasmic sperm injection. So once you have checked for fertilization, you allow the fertilized embryos to grow in the incubator up to day 3 or up to day 5 if you're taking them up to a blastocyst. At that point, you will know how many embryos you have got. You decide whether you want to do a fresh transfer and transfer two embryos into the woman's uterus right in that cycle, or for some reason, depending on that case specific scenario, you have decided to freeze all the embryos, then you freeze all the embryos and put them back in a later cycle.
So when you freeze the embryos and you thaw them, obviously, and are you decreasing the chance of the embryo catching on? Does it make a difference?
No. Definitely not. Globally, frozen embryo transfers are very safe and they have excellent pregnancy rates, sometimes more than fresh transfers, though fresh transfers are still indicated for a certain subset of patients. Sure. There are many who where there are multiple follicles growing, where there's a risk of ovarian hyperstimulation. The endometrial quality will be poor in those cases and the receptivity will be low. So we always prefer to do a freeze-all and put them back at a later stage. I think the longest period of time embryos have been stored and have given children has been said to be about 30 years.
Oh, wow.
30-year-old embryos have been capable of giving a child. But in India, current law states that we can freeze them only up to 10 years.
10 years. Moving on, let's say the woman has gotten pregnant. I generally think, especially in India, a woman gets really good prenatal, perinatal care. But I want to switch to postnatal care. What happens to the woman after she has given birth? Do they talk about postpartum depression? Is there options for pelvic physiotherapy, things like that? How is the current status there?
Yes, as you said, there is a spotlight on the mother all through the pregnancy.
Yes, big time.
That spotlight suddenly switches all over to the baby after the child is born. And sometimes you are completely left, I would say, caught unawares about what to expect postpartum. And that's why the concept of the fourth trimester, the most important trimester, comes in as such. Okay. So the next 3 months after childbirth, it is very important to prepare them, educate them about what to expect physically, mentally, emotionally, mm-hmm. the changes which they are going to go through. Childbirth is difficult on a woman's body.
Yes.
And her mind. No question about it.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's going to be a normal delivery or it is going to be a cesarean section, you have gone through a lot. And lactation can be especially challenging period for many.
Yes.
Because we see them struggling day in and day out. They have given birth. So you think that, okay, my job is over.
Oh, yeah,
but
no.
I would say the job is starting right
yes,
now. All the
absolutely.
Hard work is starting right now. So you have to be prepared. The total lack of sleep which one has can be a rude shock to many
mm-hmm.
people.
Mm-hmm.
We are at least used to it somewhat with the night duties we used to do.
Yes.
And staying up many hours. But most people are really not used to having their sleep disrupted this
yes.
way.
Yes.
And that can totally throw their whole lives out of sync. their relationship with their husband. The first enemy number one becomes the mother.
Yes,
even
absolutely.
Yesterday I was saying, ma'am, you are checking whether milk is coming. She's staying silent. If I do the same, if I go to touch her, she's just screaming at me was the complaint I got during the inpatient rounds. So you have to educate them. We have antenatal classes, and during the antenatal classes, nowadays we have a lot of patients asking whether the husband can be present during childbirth.
Good.
So
okay.
I say the husband should be aware of what to do to help
mm-hmm.
the wife. Otherwise,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be useless to have him inside the labor room. If he knows what to do, how to support the woman who's laboring, of course, he's going to be welcome. So he should know how to take care of the baby. And the last session I send them for is labor preparation and breastfeeding awareness.
Okay.
Once they reach 36 weeks. So they have to be ready to deal with breastfeeding. They have to know what to expect, what is normal, what is not. So that because once we talk to them beforehand, they are prepared. If you're going to give all this information about after childbirth, they are in no way ready to receive that. They'll be in pain. The baby will be crying all the time. Their brain is not going to process that information. They will have complete mommy's brain, which will
yes.
be focused on the baby
baby
and the
baby.
Survival of the baby.
Honestly, I have to say this. I refused to go for any of my prenatal classes. During our residency, our house surgery, we've delivered about 100 babies in that
yes.
1 month of labor ward posting. I know what pregnancy is going to be. I know what labor is going to be. Did not prepare my brain for breastfeeding or this and that. Oh my God, what a shock it was.
Yes.
So even if you're a doctor, you should attend those antenatal classes.
Definitely. Even being a gynecologist, my own personal experience was pretty challenging,
mm-hmm.
especially lactation.
Oh,
even
God.
The C-section, I knew sort of it was straightforward what to expect, but breastfeeding can be definitely very, very different for different
yes,
women
yes.
and the experiences are going to be totally different.
And then this pressure to breastfeed, breast milk is the best milk, and the pressure on the mother, new mother, is just so ridiculous that there's all this, at least, I mean, I'm not sure how much it is here, but in the US, it's almost like a movement, it's a religion, like, you know, breastfeeding mothers are like, it's a cult almost.
Yeah.
They just torture you. I still remember I slept behind the wheel because I went back to work. I slept behind the wheel, then kind of veered my car towards the side, slammed the brakes. My car spun around. And then I was like, okay. I'm going to stop nursing. Okay. I mean, this because thank God it was at 4:45 in the morning,
yes.
And the highway did not have any other cars or something like that. Otherwise, I would have been killed 3 months after my first baby.
I know. So you have to do what's best for you,
yes.
And your baby.
Yes.
No mother is a bad mother. So do what works for you. And as you rightly said, don't let others' expectations and society's expectations dictate what is best for you and your child.
Yes, yes. I'm glad to say. I'm not sure whether everyone's aware of it, but there's a huge Facebook group called Physicians Mom Group, PMG,
okay.
Right? It has, you're not aware, okay, there are close to 70,000 doctors who are mothers in that group.
Okay.
It is an amazing support system, etc. So there are obviously women from mothers, doctors who are from different countries. And then someone was talking about pelvic physiotherapy after childbirth. And somebody from the United Kingdom was like, what do you mean? Why are you guys even talking about it? This is a part of our process. We all get 12 weeks of pelvic physiotherapy after childbirth. And I was like, what is she even talking about?
Okay.
Even though I was a doctor, I never even knew there is a thing called pelvic physiotherapy, which can help regain your pelvic muscle strength and stuff like that. How is that in India? Do you all do that?
Is not very prevalent, to be frank. But what we do is, because we have a physiotherapy assisted team right there in the hospital handle the antenatal preparation, labor support if the patients ask for it. Typically, when they come for me, my 45-day visit, I ask them to meet the pelvic physiotherapist for exercises. So, it's for their core strengthening, back strengthening exercises, as well as their pelvic floor. If they have a C-section, it's a C-section scar massage, what to do to lessen the pain and the healing around it to be better. And if they have an episiotomy, it's again to reduce the fibrosis and scarring. The gentle massage techniques are taught.
Okay.
Otherwise, they may go in for pain during sexual intercourse at a later date. So we do send them to the physiotherapist for lactation support, as well as all these concerns when they come back at 45 days. And nowadays, I've started asking them to come back at 3 months to make sure that they are following up on their contraception advice, as well as probably move them and check how they're doing with their exercises.
Good, good. That's awesome. That's good to know. That there's so much support you're able to give your patients. That's really fantastic. Okay, now let's go to the next phase in a woman's life. Perimenopause and postmenopause. We were talking about it earlier. It seems like a gold rush. Everyone is talking about hormone replacement therapy. But but in India, even, you know, we are sitting here in Chennai, India, even now I feel women are reluctant to talk about that phase of their lives. What is your take?
Definitely, menopause is something which every woman is going to go through.
Yes.
Whether you go through pregnancy, delivery is optional, but menopause is something every woman is going to go through. So there's a shocking lack of awareness about the risks which you may be facing in menopause. Menopause is somehow associated with aging. And it's as if you have reached your use by expiry date or something.
Yes.
So post 50 years, no one's really bothered about you. Yeah. Job done, had the children, and now you are ready to age.
As if our only purpose is to deliver the children.
Yeah, birth and reproduce and be done with it. And especially in a society like ours, that's how women see themselves. That's also there. It's not only how society, they have been conditioned that way.
True,
women see themselves. Okay, my job is over. My children are grown up. I have got them married. My job is done. I can now get old and die.
My God.
So that's not the mindset we really want to have right now. Maybe that was something which was in the previous generations more relevant. But right now, there are so many things. Life starts after 50, at 60,
yes.
Or whatever age you want it to. There are so many opportunities to redefine yourself. So you should be thinking about taking better care of your health, especially as you age. everyone wants to have an independent life. Mm-hmm. If you ask everyone, they know, I don't want to trouble my children. I want to stay healthy till I die. But what are they doing about it? What steps are they taking to ensure that they are independent at 80? The work doesn't start when you're 80. Absolutely. It starts much earlier when you're in your late 30s, right? So this is a space I've started getting very interested in. Probably I'm right now, we're all in that phase, I guess. So yes. I've been reading up a lot. And as even as a typical OB-GYN, you don't get a lot of information or education about menopause, even in your med school and in your OB-GYN residency also. So this is something you have to cultivate and seek knowledge, I would say, and stay aware with the current trends.
So actually, let me I'm going to ask you a different question, actually. After you have, you know, the prepartum, that is before pregnancy, after pregnancy, do women come for regular checkups? You know, regular screening and all when they are not pregnant, do they actually come to a gynecologist?
No, that's a very good question. In the US, you would have annual Bellman checks or gynec checks.
Yes.
Here, people do not want to step into the gynecologist's office once they've had a child, unless they're really pushed to for some reason. Because they do not want to have an internal examination. That's going to be painful. I've had my children, my PVs are over, just be done with it. No one wants to come to us. But it is very, very important that they come once a year. And that is what I keep writing, annual visit, even when they come for other reasons. And if they have come for a completely unrelated reason to me, non-gynecological problem, I always make sure I do a breast examination, I do an internal examination to check the cervix, because they're not going to come back all that often. True, so true, when they are there in your office, you have to make optimal use of it.
So now let's come back to hormone replacement therapy. Are there options available for women in India? I mean, do they get the progesterone, or, you know, are there options available?
There are options available, but they are nowhere near the options you would have in your Western countries or in the US. It's very, very less. You do have oral hormone replacement therapy. You do have patches, but you don't have a lot of other things as such. The creams, gels and rings and things that. And even the dosages, I would say, they're going to be much more limited patch-wise and product-wise compared to what options you would have in the US. Probably because the uptake is very less and where the need is not there, the supply is not going to be there.
See, I feel like it's become a movement in the Western world, right? Lot of the Hollywood actresses have come out and say, I'm in menopause and it's terrible, etc. I feel that the movement has not caught on in India. Maybe women don't want to declare that they are in the menopausal age or something like that. And it's really sad to see that women are not owning this part of their life as well, you know?
Maybe because they don't know that it is related to menopause.
True.
I have my assistants, when a woman, typically any new patient walks in, my assistant takes a complete history, writing down all the complaints she lists, because first thing is we need to listen to them to know what they're having however irrelevant it may seem to us or to her. So she makes a long list of symptoms, and if I had to treat each symptom, I would have to send them to a gastroenterologist, to a neurologist for headaches, to an orthopedician for the joint pains and aches. So there are so many different, all across the board, you have the symptoms coming up. So now, retrospectively, when I started reading more and more about menopause, I think it may be a lot to do with the usual perimenopause symptoms which they are facing, rather than anything to do with specifically one joint disorder or disease. So first, it starts with awareness, educating them about what to expect in their phase of lives. And that's why I think I'm very much interested in doing more in this space about spreading awareness and education, which is totally lacking here.
Yes. You know, menopause is, the perimenopausal symptoms, but there's also bone health involved, right? And women, our muscle mass is so low compared to the men. And when the hormone change is happening, the osteoporosis risk is also high. Can you talk
about that? Yes, definitely. Because breast cancer risk is about, lifetime risk is 15%, but the risk of a major fracture or is about 17%, it is definitely higher than the risk of breast cancer or at least equal to it. But no one is bothered about this very important topic, right?
Yes.
Osteoporosis. They just think that, it is a part of aging. Your bones are going to get weaker. You may have a fracture, but if you sustain a hip fracture, it is going to be debilitating. It may reduce by 50% your chances of being able to walk independently or live independently. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the risk of mortality is about 20% within a year.
Yes.
So it is a major, major thing which people should be concerned about falls, about the risk of fractures. But these are all things which are often not talked about. So everyone's only focused on maybe heart disease, breast cancer. Hormones equals cancer.
Yes.
Hormones is a bad word. Yes. No, I do not want hormones.
You know, do you want to talk about the initiative you are planning ahead in the future with the menopause?
Yes, because as I said, menopause space is definitely, it's a huge void in India right now. So we are just planning a two-day workshop, sort of awareness workshop, covering different aspects of menopause. It's not only weight gain. It's not
yes.
only skin and hair changes, which are all superficial, important, no doubt about it, but all the hidden dangers, which is your risk of heart disease, your risk of osteoporosis, and your risk of dementia, and so many other things which you're going to be facing if you do not take adequate measures, lifestyle modification. What are the things you should be doing? Muscle strengthening. People talk, think that you're crazy if you ask them to lift weights.
Yes.
What, at my age, I'm going to enjoy myself. No, this is exactly for the reverse, to prevent injury, to prevent and to strengthen your bones. You need to start lifting. You need to start doing resistance training. So these are deeply ingrained sort of misinformation mm-hmm. which is there. So they have to unlearn certain concepts before they can relearn, which is what we are going to aim to be doing somewhere in March, all things working out well.
Fantastic. That sounds really, really
I'm going to call it the Meno Party, because I've said menopause doesn't have to be a pause to life.
Yes.
It can be a start to something.
Absolutely.
Really a different phase of your life. It's how you look at it. See, now your children are grown up, you have more time on your hands, you're independent, you're wise. This is a beautiful stage of your life to be in. So enjoy it. Make sure you're going to work towards increasing your health span rather than your lifespan.
Lifespan. Yeah. I absolutely love it. Mm-hmm. That's what this whole reboot is all about. You can reboot your life at any time. And menopause does not have to, as you said, pause your life.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Priya, we are coming close to the end of our podcast. If there is a message you want to give out to the audience, to the women who are afraid to come to you because they've done with their children, etc., what would it be to them?
Gynecologists can be pretty intimidating, and it is mostly, I think, because women are scared of the internal examination. But nowadays, the modern day gynecologist is very open, non-judgmental, willing to listen to what you have to say. And I promise you, we can be gentle and not do painful things or scare you too much. So it is very, very vital that you come to us to discuss certain aspects of your health, which you would not be able to discuss with any other person. So please do visit us once a year, and we can cover so many aspects about your health and help you understand how to take care of yourself better too.
Well said, Dr. Priya. Thank you so much for coming here. I honestly have learned so many things I have not heard since medical school. I heard today. It was very informative, very educative, and it was really fun talking
thank
to you.
Thank you so much, and I've also enjoyed my time talking to you here. Thank you.
Thank you. That's it, folks. This is the end of another episode of Reboot with Dr. R.C. Maran. I hope you found this episode fun and educative as well. See you next time.